We are offering freelance services in data analytics, machine learning, audio engineering, and web development. Feel free to check out our website services section to see our portfolio and what we can do, and book a call with us to discuss your data challenges. We'll be happy to help you out. This is Data for Future. Enjoy this episode. Good day, good afternoon, whatever the time you're listening. I'm very, very, very excited today to introduce our new guest, Eduardo, who has an incredible, marvelous project that I was that I met recently, that I found on internet thanks to a friend. And yeah, Eduardo is the founder and head of innovation of the project, which is called AI Scope. And this is a project about using low-cost microscopes and training neural nets, and then combining these two things together to diagnose infectious diseases like malaria using blood tests, which I found incredible. And also another thing that I would like to talk about today with Eduardo is his experience in working as AI consultant freelance, which me personally, and I guess many people out there, are interested in and maybe would like to try it out themselves. So yeah, a warm welcome, Eduardo. It's nice to have you here.
Hi, yeah, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm also really happy to be here.
All right, so why don't you start by introducing AI Scope a bit more, maybe telling us, maybe starting with the story, how did you even come to the idea? And I guess there are, like, this problem is a huge one, infectious diseases like malaria especially, but why this one? Why not any other cutting problems in, out there in the world?
Yeah, so AI Scope, we are a nonprofit organization made by a group of many, many people who we share many common interests in technology and also using technology for good. The idea of AI Scope is to create a smart microscope that is open source and that uses a cell phone to diagnose diseases. Not only malaria, we started with malaria because malaria is somehow easy to find and easy to find data around and easy to engage with people. Because if you talk about Chagas, nobody knows what Chagas is, but also it's something important to treat. And it started as a project, as a, how it's called, like a final course project of a machine learning bootcamp. Actually, I was going to the data science retreat in Berlin, and I had to choose a project. I'm a mechanical engineer myself, so I like to build things as well. So I decided to do something that I could also build. And that's how everything started. It started getting traction and more traction and more traction. And yeah, and I decided, okay, why not to scale this, invite more people to join, because it was fun. Like, I was explaining about the project in many places, and always somebody would come like, hey, could I give you a hand? Do you need this? Do you need that? And then I thought, okay, that's amazing. People like it. Let's put more wood here into the fire. And yeah, that's how it grew. Right now we are many people. I could not say how many because as everybody's a volunteer, we come and go, and there are people that stay there for months, then they leave for some months because they need to do things, which is totally understandable. And then they come back. So yeah, I would say like we are like around 20, 30 people that come and go all the time. Yeah, I'm super proud of this.
No, that's really awesome. And I'm like, it sounds very exciting because, you know, also our podcast is centered about how to use AI for good. There are thousands of different applications how you could use the technology for a social good, for an environmental cause. But one of the things that I think prevents many data scientists from going into the field is maybe the lack of, I might speak about myself, lack of expertise in certain topics. So you might be good at data science, but then, I mean, if you want to launch a project that aims at treating diseases, it sounds really hard to launch this kind of project without having that kind of expertise. So if you say you're a mechanical engineer, how do you get this knowledge? Do you like contract people on a freelance basis, or you have friends? How does it work that you combine these two fields together?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting thing, because one of the key things of technology is that technology needs to be multidisciplinary. So you can be an amazing coder, but develop something super technologically advanced that has no meaning for society or to solve any problem. Or you can be at the other side. You could be a brilliant doctor. You have extremely deep knowledge on many things, but your knowledge in technology is so basic that you cannot develop something useful or something at least cutting edge. So you need to, and that's something that we did really well, of putting people together, of having doctors, microscopists, programmers, and also more business-oriented people, even though it's not a business. But it's interesting to bring the business mentality of making things lean. And because coders like to do things extremely technologically advanced, which sometimes are not needed. So you have to bring them to reality sometimes. Doctors sometimes, they know what they need, but they don't know how to externalize this. And then the first information that they give you is useful, but it's not useful enough. You have to create that a lot. So that's why having business people there also helped us to say that, is that real, or there is something behind what the doctor is saying that we should really tackle instead of the first thing that the person is saying? And that helped us to, like, for example, we are creating an app to create a global diseases dataset that also is going to be open. And that helps us a lot to synthesize all the information that we were receiving to create this app. Because if we would have followed everybody's thoughts, it would have been something super complex, something with too many buttons and options and things. And at the end, if you put a lot of you think, and then you like refurbish everything and go again and again, you start deleting things, putting things together, and then making things that it's usable actually, because you want to create something useful and usable, because if it's not usable, it's not going to be used. And also one of our situations, it's not like a problem, but it's a thing that we face, is that we are a non-profit and we really have no money here, so we cannot pay people to do things. So if something is boring and not the usability is poor, they won't use it. So we need to do something that it's so convenient for them that they want to use that. And that's really a key thing as well. Because if you're Microsoft, you do something that the usability is poor, but you hire 1,000 microscopists and they have to do the job. It's going to be slower, but they will do the job. If we do something that the usability is poor, after 3 images, they're going to stop. And that's something that we put a lot of effort in.
Wow. So I guess the conclusion would be, like, I think it's so important that you say, like, the multidisciplinary knowledge and expertise, I guess the best is when you have both parts of the knowledge. But as you say, like, collaboration is a very powerful tool as well. But then I think it's also very important to communicate your ideas very clearly and to speak the language of the other person, like to speak the language of doctors in this case, and that the doctors can speak the programming, the coding language as well, which is challenging sometimes. Yeah. So yeah, very interesting. And just to clarify, who is the final user of the microscope? Is it doctors? Is it just people who are very educated, people with low-level education? Who is it in the end?
So at the end, the objective is to bring a tool that will diagnose in remote areas. So sometimes people misunderstand the project and they believe it's a tool that you can diagnose yourself, which could also be, but really that doesn't really make sense to me. So what we want to do is that people are able to perform a diagnosis without, or maybe not a diagnosis, but a triage. So knowing if they are sick and they have to visit a doctor without the need of a microscopist, because having microscopists is expensive and it's also difficult to find, because a microscopist is somebody who has gone under a training for many years. And you not always find microscopies everywhere. And they cannot work and all the time. So the idea here is that you have a tool that maybe a nurse can take a blood sample, make a preparation, and put it into a machine, and the machine will tell, okay, you most certainly have malaria or any other disease, go to a doctor. So obviously we are not diagnosing here. Well, what we are saying is we are giving a hand to know if you really need to go to a doctor or not. Because yeah, most of the many countries what they have, so there are many countries that they have a lot of malaria and that's a problem. They need to know if they are sick or not. But there are other countries that they have really low incidence. So every positive that they test, it's extremely costly in money for them. But they still have to do the whole process. So if they can reduce this money, they are going to save a lot of money for them, which is really good.
Okay, yeah, that's also very cool. Because I thought it's actually for people. This was my initial idea as well, that you can, me, like I might live in a rural area, take the microscope, do the blood test. Yeah. Maybe it's also a bit naive now when I think about this. Wow, pretty cool. And how do you do the user experience part? Do you, like, how do you test and iterate and make all of those steps to make the product actually usable?
So we collaborate with health centers all over the world. And what we do is have a close communication with them, send them every update that we do, and have calls and have constant share of information between both parts to see what happens. And again, you see sometimes, this tool, it's meant for a broad spectrum of people. It's not just millennials with a deeply understanding of technology. It can be also by other people who maybe are not that native with technology. And it's also interesting here because when you understand, when you create a user experience thing, you think that people, that users are gonna follow the path that you created, and you get surprised a lot. And that's a bit the thing. So like we see what they do, then we go back and we say, okay, let's do it this other way.
Any examples of this?
Let me think. So basically like misunderstanding things of the labeling tool many times, many, many, many times. Small things like, but I understand, like everybody's busy. Even though we give a whole documentation, like not documentation, like how to use this app, some of the people don't fully read these things, and like they have to mark the parasite and paint on top of the parasite. Some of them circle the parasite or things like this. So yeah, things like this all the time. So we have, and at the end, every time that the user, so like the user does something wrong, it's not the user's fault, it's our fault. So we need to put more effort, and we are putting a lot of effort into this, into making that the user can not make mistakes. So that it's so easy that, because also like we are going to people from many, 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 many different backgrounds, from people who barely has used a cell phone because they live in a rural area and they really have a really low contact with technology. Sometimes you get surprised, like we live here, like we are right now in Barcelona, and we are really used to technology that even grandpas, grandmas know how to use a cell phone. But you get surprised sometimes. And sometimes you even have to explain basic things about how the cell phone works. And yeah, but that's also the interesting part that bring, so like gives us a lot of, like a big challenge for us is that this app and this whole system can be used by many different people, not just doctors with a university degree in a big city. That would be easy. We are going to other people who maybe don't even know how to read. And yeah, it's challenging.
Wow. And as far as I know, you've launched some prototypes already in countries. I remember Peru was one of them.
Yeah.
What is the feedback pipeline? Like, is it the feedback that you gather about the usage and how, what kind of misinterpretations people do? Is it like the real users? Or you prototype somewhere here in Barcelona? Because to me, it sounds pretty challenging to communicate with the end users, especially if they don't have so much knowledge of technology and you're living 10,000 kilometers far away. How do you manage it?
Yeah, that's always challenging. Obviously, having people far away, it's something that really, like the communication and even the language barrier, it's sometimes a bit difficult because you believe that they understood, but they didn't. But one of the things that we mostly take from those trials and trips and everything is better understanding of the needs. Because so one of the things that we, and that's why we want to involve so many different people, we don't want to fall into the mistake of believing that we know everything and that we know the solution. No, we go there really naively and with our ears and eyes open, and we go there to listen what they say. They are always super happy because what happens in all those countries is that they cannot perform as many tests as they would love to. And that's because, yeah, what we said, it's expensive and you need to have qualified people. And there are countries that they may have like 10 qualified microscopists in the whole country. Mm. And yeah, you cannot test the whole country with 10 people. Mm. Because like a malaria test can take between 15 and almost 40 minutes, depending who makes it and how. So yeah, it's time consuming for each people, expending like an average of a half an hour. And that's the thing. So with AIScope, it's going to be, we don't really know how fast it's going to be because our tests are still in really early stage in this part. But the good thing is that it's going to be automatic. So you will be able to put different samples in different microscopes and they will perform the sample automatic, which even though might be even much slower, but you can perform many at the same time. So at the end, the average time is going to be faster.
Although when you say automatic, like, I kind of imagined it in the first place that the humans are phased out of the whole process, but as you say, you still need a nurse or someone.
Yeah.
So in the end, it's still kind of a collaboration between the technology and, exactly, and humans. Really interesting. And also like so important and so trivial what you say, like that, like congratulations on this kind of mindset that, yeah, we don't know really what the users want and what their needs are. And I think, you know, in business especially, the lean approach of getting the feedback of the user, of iterating and making your product better, I think it's pretty established there. But in terms of sustainability, I kind of have, sometimes I have a feeling that people don't make so much use of this kind of mindset, that they kind of assume that, okay, this is what the world needs. Whereas in the end, you might build something with a really good intention, but that will be of very little use. Very unfortunate. And
it happens a lot of times.
Yeah, exactly. And so one of the things that I also imagine happened with the AIScope, or maybe not, is when you start to get feedback and to understand the needs better, also the project and the product might change and you might make a shift or a pivot. Did you have to go through the same steps, and how did the project evolve over time?
Yeah, so we have been pivoting a lot, like not like pivoting like crazy, because there are people and startups that they like crazily pivot, or they start doing one thing and they do after some months totally something different. No, our goal is exactly the same, but the way to reach it has been pivoting a lot. So one of our ideas was to create a whole microscope from scratch, and also the idea that it had to be do it yourself. Not also open source, because everything that we do is open source, but also the do-it-yourself thing. With the time, we have realized that developing a whole microscope is time-consuming, and we already have a really nice project, so we cannot spend all this time developing a whole microscope. And also, making it do-it-yourself, it's crazy. It's, how can you assure that somebody makes it properly? So that is the thing. That's why we are pivoting and we are testing other options, for example, in this field. One of the things would be to automatize one existing microscope, which that's something that I would like a lot, because there are microscopes everywhere. So there has been NGOs sending microscopes to the whole world always, since many years. They are in okay condition sometimes, but they are there. And obviously, a factory-made microscope is going to be always better than a microscope that somebody has done in their basement with a laser cutter. and assembled by hand, obviously. And it's also really difficult. We have made many, many prototypes, like, I don't remember exactly, like 8 or 9 or something like this. And I remember building them with super glue. And like, fuck, that's hard. How somebody should do this? Like, even myself who... Yeah, exactly. So like, but like, I remember one of the first ones, like even myself who just developed the thing, like I created the thing and I designed it 2 days before. I was having problems to assemble this. And yeah, so that's why we are trying to maybe also collaborating with other open source projects that they created, microscopes, things like this. And that's also one of the cool things that we are also happy to collaborate with everybody. And but that's the thing that, yeah, we have been pivoting a lot. And like keeping the focus in mind, but always pivoting. So with this labeling app, now it works on the cell phone. But at the beginning, we wanted to work it. I don't even remember, like, I remember we had a computer program to label, but I don't remember how were we supposed to take the pictures, but we realized the process was super difficult. And yeah, like every single thing has been changing. And even at the beginning, we wanted the project to run in a Raspberry Pi, but then we realized that on one hand, they are not as powerful as to perform like real-time computer vision, like a real-time object location. And on the other, if you buy a Raspberry Pi and start adding components, it ends up being really expensive. So like you buy the Raspberry Pi and a camera and whatever GPS thing and a connectivity other thing. And at the end, you paid almost like a cell phone. And the cell phone, like, yeah, and a screen, because you need to see it somewhere. And the cell phone goes, way better. And it's everything pre-made. You can just buy them and ship them.
So right now it's a cell phone that you use in pair with the microscope, and it will give you the same output, basically.
Yeah.
And the microscopes are the ones that already there that might be shipped by NGOs, by humanitarian aid, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. So what we do right now, so we found, and that also has to do with the pivoting thing, like the idea is that we attach a cell phone to a microscope with an adapter. And ideally, in the future, the cell phone will also move the microscope. So we started developing an adapter to adapt the cell phone to the microscope, because the ones that we found in internet were not that good. And what happened is that we spent many months developing one. We developed something super cool, and then we found one super cool online already for 30 euros. And yeah, we had to, be humble and say, okay, makes more sense to buy them than develop them. Because at the end, everything that you are developing, it's costly. And we have to focus in our core thing, which is creating something to find the pathogens, not just all the whole environment around this.
Wow, that's so cool. I mean, it's also so nice to hear that someone has the same kind of experience. I guess everyone has the same kind of experience where you want to build something and then you realize there is a much easier way. And maybe everything you have done so far is not for nothing, but there is a better way, so why don't you choose the other one? Yeah. But I guess what you say is it's helping a lot when you have the end goal, the thing that you actually want to solve. In your case, it's to identify diseases with whatever technology and whatever tools that might be available. You might want to build one, you might just buy one on the internet. But yeah, I think this experience is very, as you say, humbling, but also if you remind yourself of the goal, it's the right thing to do.
Exactly. And you need to be objective. And at the end, you want to solve a problem. You don't want to put medals on you by developing many, many things. So if we can, and that's also one of the things that I keep saying that all the time, like now we are building this data set that hopefully is going to be the biggest one in the world of infectious diseases. But if somebody comes with a better algorithm, they are welcome to use it. They are welcome to use the thing and say, hey, we did it better. Yeah, it's amazing. Good for you. I'm super happy. Yeah, because at the end, we want to solve this problem. We don't want to put medals on us.
And I would even say this is a social entrepreneurship project, because it is born from the problem out there in the world, not from the solution that's looking for a problem, so to say. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
As you say, it's open source. amazing. I love, like, open source is, I think, driving the real, the collaboration, which is out there in the world, especially in the coder world and a data science world. For instance, one of the projects that I was doing was also everything done with public data. And normally people are amazed how much is out there, although there are many, many more things to build, many, much more data to gather, like in your case, you're doing an incredible job. But how do you finance this kind of project? Maybe, yeah, you can tell what worked well and what didn't. I think it's a very useful experience as well.
Yeah, that's actually a really tricky question, because that's one of our biggest problems. And actually, so like, we have this weird situation that we are not part of a university, although we collaborate with many, and we are not a company, because we are a non-profit organization. And we are creating things, but we are open source, so we don't have rights or patents or things like this. So we are in this, it's like the totally, I don't know the words for this, but that would be like the opposite of sweet spot. So like, nobody likes us. So whenever we apply for a grant, you're not part of a university. Whenever an accelerator comes to us, like, oh yeah, but you're not going to be profitable. And so we have tried many different things. And for example, this year is going to be the year of the communications, once COVID allows us to do things. But until the moment, there was a moment that I thought to myself, okay, it makes no sense to spend more time creating big projects to present to contests or to grants or things like this, because you spend many, many hours for this. So I end up paying everything myself. So I decided, and actually, yeah, like all the hours we were spending them, it's even cheaper to work them and pay them myself right now. Because for the output that we were becoming, that was the best approach. Also, there are some companies that they give us help. For example, there is a company called ThoughtWorks that they have this nice policy that they allow they promote some social projects between their people, and they allow them to work, I don't remember exactly, like a 20% of the hours or whenever they are between projects or something like this, to work for us in their work hours, which is also super cool, because yeah, we get like top class engineers and business developers for nothing. Also, the other thing, like companies as well, nobody gave us money ever, but they like the project, they like to be nearby and they like to help. So for example, when we needed cell phones, I reached many companies, and at the beginning there was one Spanish one called PQ, and they gave us free cell phones. But then they closed the company. That was a bit weird. But now Xiaomi is giving us cell phones, which is super cool, because we get like top class cell phones and for free, which is one of the biggest expenses that we had. So it's, yeah, because basically now, like, yeah, we have this, the adapters, which are cheap, and all the cloud services, which honestly are just jokingly cheap. Like every month I pay from Google Cloud, I don't remember, like 60 cents or something like this. I don't even check the invoices, because I know they are just like insanely cheap. Because also one of the things that keeps our costs down low is that we don't have many users, because our users are highly skilled. Not everybody can be taking pictures and labeling. So like, we have microscopies that before they start, we interview them and we talk to them many times so that we know they're the right people. So like, for us, if we in a couple of years we have 200 users, we are the luckiest NGO in the world, because that means like a total success.
Crazy. I guess the good thing about making data science for good, AI for good, anything for good with a social purpose is that people, as you say, are always very, they want to help. The companies, the people, the organizations. So if there is any angel investor, yes, you know where to invest, right here. And in terms of earning your bread and butter, I know that you have been, for the last couple of minutes, I would like to discuss this with you. I know how you have been freelancing as well as a machine learning consultant. This is something that I would really love to do, and maybe in the next couple of years, I would like to try myself out in this field. I think it's really exciting to do freelance job. But also what I'm discovering right now is that machine learning is the very last step of the whole data pipeline. So when you're in my understanding for now, at least, there is not so much to do, I would say. But if I meet someone who has been a real freelancer as AI consultant, I have tons of questions, like what your clients are, how do you find them? So yeah, tell us more about your experience in this field.
Yeah, definitely. So being a freelancer data scientist can be tricky and difficult, because the thing is, like, companies like having like data scientists and people who does machine learning in-house all the time, because they are developing a inner know-how about the company that they want to keep there. So that's why it's kind of difficult. And this idea that there are some developers and people like this, that they can be working 2 weeks in a project, a week in another, 2 months in another project, and they keep switching from countries. This is a bit more difficult in machine learning, because when you start doing something there and it starts being nice and the people from the company starts liking it, they want you to stay. And they offer you money to stay, and they just book all your hours to stay, and they like you to stay. Finding projects, it's also, I mean, that's also something I talk with any kind of freelancer all the time. Because, and I think many of us, we have like the same weird feeling that projects come at you. So one important thing, and that's something that everybody needs to have clear, you need to have a really nice portfolio. Because, and that's something super, super, super important, because I don't care what you have studied, I care what you can do and how you solve the problems. So if you have a nice portfolio, a library that you wrote, an algorithm that you did for whatever weird thing, it showed that you wanted, so you have the motivation to start things and find all the information to solve those problems. Because nowadays, we have everything on the internet. So in Stack Overflow, everybody would have had the same problem you had before. Everybody. But there are people who don't want to spend their time and their motivation into this. And there are others who they do like to do this. So the ones who do this are the ones who get the project all the time. That's how it goes. So also there are recruiters, there are these consultant big companies. I have a friend, for example, who works for different big consultant companies. And they ask him, like, hey, could you fly there and do this 2-week project? And things like this. But yeah, like, I think a lot of people get a bit disappointed about the freelancing work as a data scientist. Maybe if you focus it in a way of maybe, don't know, like being a professional on data acquisition or being a professional or something that you can go solve the problem and leave. Maybe that's a thing that they would like to have you for a couple of weeks, but otherwise they want you to stay. And that's how it goes. Yeah, data analysis is a different thing. So if you're analyzing data, they tend to call you because they don't know how to, because like they have talented people, but maybe they don't know how to code and join two databases. And that happens a lot of times. You go there, you join the two databases, you make some kind of query or like the equivalent with Python, and then you're gone. Two weeks after, you're gone. But yeah, it's a bit, I know that doesn't sound that lovely, but so it's definitely possible to have remote jobs, that's for sure. But freelancing in machine learning can be difficult.
That's also so interesting. I've never really thought about this, but normally when you're a freelancer, you want your customers to come back, your clients. You want your clients to come back because, I mean, this is your job in the end of the day. But I've never thought about this from this perspective, that if they come back too much, it stops to be actually a freelance job. Yeah, very, very interesting. And portfolio, wow. I mean, for me, this was the biggest reason, one of the biggest reasons to join the field of data science. Because at the end, no one really cares about your degree. And what is really favored and valued in the field is that you are able to do stuff. And I guess for many people out there, including me, academia, going from bottom to up, starting with theory and going to practice in years, is not the best approach. So, yeah, very inspiring.
Regarding what you just said about academia, so I believe there are different approaches of data science. And there are also different kinds of data scientists, and they are required for different jobs. So academia people, they are really needed because they develop really complex new things. So, for example, if you work for a company like Facebook, for example, they would love to have some academia people or Apple that they develop their own machine learning algorithms behind. So that's something that normal data scientists might not do. They might apply what already is existing, modify that, and this, which is also really needed because once develop the technology and once build the engine and the others build the car. And at the end, you want a car, but you cannot have a car without an engine. And that's the thing, you need these super clever people putting the engine together and saying, okay, yeah, this is going to work this way. And the others who might be a bit more pragmatic, looking for usage for this new technology. Because that happens many, many times that people, again, even going back to what we said about AI scope, that many people many developers develop super complex things that has no real goal and not real purpose. But if you mix that with the right amount of pragmacity, then you have something useful. And that's like the sweet spot.
Yeah, that's very interesting as well. Like I've been maybe a bit too critical of the of the academia field, but yeah, I guess it's also very different jobs, as you say. Yeah, AI research, cutting edge, you know, making the next steps in this cutting edge technology, which evolves every day. And the other thing is using existing tools.
Somebody needs to develop what it will be used in 10 years. Because what we are using right now is something that it was already developed before. So let's be honest with this. We might invent some tiny things, obviously, but yeah, we need people to push forward and say, okay, let's find another thing that is not going to be convolutional neural networks. Let's find the next thing. And yeah, and they will find it, they will test it, they will use a massive amount of computational power that now makes no sense to use it because it's too expensive. But in 10 years, the whole algorithm is going to be simplified, the computational power, it would have increased drastically, and it will be something useful that you will use in your cell phone to put yourself ears on Snapchat.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is how technology evolves and how we use cell phones right now that have computers that were unimaginable decades ago. Wow, this has been a very big pleasure for me to have you here. Before we close up, I would like to give you a minute of glory and you might share anything you want to share in case you need help with your project, in case you're looking for more people and collaboration. Also leave us your contact. I will leave the link in the description. But yeah, feel free to let people know how to reach out and maybe give them any hints to the topic.
Perfect. Yeah, so in AI scope, we are always looking for volunteers. So it's a really fun environment with many, many people who are really, really engaged with the project. And we look for volunteers in almost every single area, designers, UX, UI people, obviously computer people. We are developing our app in Kotlin. So whoever knows Kotlin, it's also super welcome. Machine learning people as well. Like any kind of people who wants to give us a hand, obviously also doctors and people who has contacts in the field. That's always welcome. So yeah, please, if you feel that you can or you like to give us a hand, just feel free to contact. Yeah, I will share with him my email so you can just reach me directly.
Cool, sounds awesome. Thanks again for being here. And it's very nice to meet you in person. In times of coronavirus, it's not as easy. It has been a great discussion.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to come here.